Good evening, and welcome everyone to the first of our series of writers at MMU. The first of a number of events that will be happening this term and next term, and indeed beyond Easter. It's a great pleasure for me not to introduce Geoffrey Wainwright, much as I'd like to do that, but to introduce Michael Schmidt in a moment or two, who will be introducing Geoffrey. Before I do that, I wanted to mention a course that Geoffrey Wainwright is teaching for the Poetry School at the Friends Meeting House on the 20th, 27th and the 4th of December. And Linda Chase from the Poetry School is right here. She has further details of that if anyone would like to find out more after this reading. This, as I've said, is the first of our Thursday evening events. Next week is the prize giving for the Manchester Poetry Prize at 7:30 next Thursday in the Music College next door. We will be giving away £10,000 for new poetry. There'll be readings from the judges, Carol Ann Duffy, Gillian Clark, and Imtiaz Darker. The following week, the novelist Jane Rogers will be speaking here. As you leave, we will press into your hands flyers giving details of further events in the season. Highlights include W.N. Herbert, Simon Armitage, Paul Mars, and Jane Griffiths. At this point, I will hand over to my friend and former colleague, Michael Schmidt, now Professor of Poetry at the University of Glasgow, Editorial and Managing Director of the Carcanet Press, who's going to introduce Geoffrey. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Andrew. I think every publisher has a different kind of relationship with each of his or her authors. And my relationship with Geoffrey has been one initially of courtship. I wanted to publish this work. He didn't want to be published at that stage. He didn't feel he was ready. And in that, I think he should be an example to all of you aspiring poets. Don't publish too soon. Judging from one of the recent reviews, I might even add that you might think that you shouldn't publish too long. But no. I think that what you should say to yourself is that Geoffrey is one of these writers who has made the mistake of spending a great deal of his time, a very happy mistake for us, writing about exploring the work of another writer, Geoffrey Hill. The assumption is always that if you have read deeply in the work of another writer, you have been somehow taken over by them. A kind of a humor occupies you, rather as Ted Hughes suggested, that humors occupy the Shakespearean heroes, and it's a matter of purging humors. I think that what is so wonderful about Clarity or Death, which for my money is my favorite book of Geoffrey since the very first book we published, the one that was the book of our courtship, if I can call it that, is the fact that he is using more voices with a diverse authority than he's ever done before. It seems to me that in this book he hasn't, as it were, stepped in the footsteps of Geoffrey Hill in any particular way. He's actually walking his own way, and he's discovering new ways of exploring his subject matter, which is, in a sense, constant all through his work, but has grown in sophistication and in nuance. I love his writing. I love the intelligence of it. That's one of the things you don't always find in contemporary poetry. I love the fact that his poems are not narrative. Some of them have narrative elements, some of them are narrative, but they're not de rigueur narrative. They have lyric elements, they have essayistic qualities, they have epistolary qualities. Some of them are spoken, some of them are sung. I hope you're not singing tonight. You did that once. There is a wonderful richness of experiment in his work. I think he is more, perhaps, than his beloved Geoffrey Hill. He is a resource for younger writers, a resource in the way that a poet like Tom Gunn is. Because when he makes a mistake, and there are mistakes in his poetry, little errors that he overlooks or that we overlook as his publishers, they are instructive. They are the product of intelligence, of ambition, of a slight overreaching rather than a failure of intelligence, a failure of technique. I think he's a wonderful writer, and I'm really thrilled to be able to introduce this, his fourth book, and I think it's the fifth of your books that we've published. But I am really proud to have had him as a colleague, especially proud to have him on my list and to have him as a friend. So, Geoffrey, read.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Will you make a sign when I make an error? Discreetly.
Okay.
Okay, thank you all very much for coming. This book, Clarity or Death, might be said to contain, will be preoccupied with ideas of one kind or another. They are indeed fairly prominent in the work. But I want to start off by insisting that a poem's energies, I hope in this case, lie mostly in the character of particular words rather than detachable ideas. Hopefully this is transmitted to you as readers and listeners, if the work's successful. But it will most likely have begun with some more personal, sense, the way that particular words sort of insinuate themselves or attach themselves like burrs to your consciousness, and probably over a very, very long spell of time, or fix themselves a very long time ago and come out much later. So I want to begin with one short poem to try to indicate what I mean. It's a poem that comes from the sequence, which is the larger part of this book, a long sequence of 39 poems called Mere Bagatelle. And in this particular case, I will put it on the screen. I used to be a lecturer, you know. I'm not going to do this with every poem, don't worry. There are things we used to call blessed, meaning damned, bootlaces, wallpapering, knitting, plug wires, anything that can get into a rubble. Blessed is the way we are here, as the world surrenders such of its simplicities as gravity and the jigger for red hair, etc., etc., but goes on and comes back for more. Now, the three words that I want to draw attention to here are this word, blessed, which is more or less the nearest that my mother ever came to a swear word, to mean damned. She wouldn't say things like that. And it's a word that becomes something of a motif. It crops up in several poems in the sequence, Mere Bagatelle. One of the reasons I like it is for these opposite meanings, that it can mean something. It can mean damned, the opposite to what its conventional meaning can be. The other word is jigger, which is a device, as many of you all know, used in all kinds of mechanical operations. More particularly, to my mind, because this is where I came across it in the first place, as a kind of lathe used in the pottery industry, in the mechanization of the making of pottery. It reproduces, a jigger reproduces, it has a stencil and it reproduces things. And the book is very interested, Clarity or Death, I mean, is very interested in similarities and in processes and in mechanics. Hence the idea here of a genetic jigger, a jigger for red hair. And thirdly, and most importantly, this word rubble, which excites Microsoft, if you try to put it in. and indeed, doesn't appear either in its own right in the OED, by which I assume that it is a dialect word. It's a word that that was very common in our household and maybe others around. But it means, as you can probably tell from the context, I hope, it means a mess. It means a tangle. Now, for me anyway, thinking and uttering, whether it verbally or orally or on paper, is something of a rubble, or it's dealing with a rubble. It's an effort to disentangle, in the sense of, I'll sort that drawer if it kills me. Now, clarity or death. And I'm actually taken, as I know many other people, you've probably heard this particular phrase of Wittgenstein's, where he talks about
about struggling with philosophical problems is like trying to mend a spider's web with your fingers. And I think that this sort of sense of trying to get a hold on and trying to get a fixity and trying to get a clear expression of particular problems and issues and ideas and words is something that we all deal with in one way or another, and that's the process, as I think, as I find it, of writing poems. Because poems are robles with tangles all their own. And one of the knots in there is the question is, what kind of a thing a poem is? What sort of relation does it bear to knowledge or information that's held in other kinds of speech or writing? Can it have any truck at all with consecutive analytic thought, as it's as known in the sciences or in philosophy? After three or four, I think, poems, the sequence of mere bagatelle breaks off and expostulates on the incongruities of the poetic and the discursive in language. And it does so under some pressure, one pressure being the expectation that poetry should, above all, deliver sense, feeling, experience, rather than ideas. And so that other kinds of words than perhaps blessed, words like there's a conjunctions, prepositions, that glue sentences together and make them work in prose, don't really belong in a poem, interlopers. And so this is indeed the fifth poem in Mere Bagatelle. Though, like, so, nevertheless, thus, therefore, sometimes, however, but, is going, loosely speaking, to be a problem here throughout, along with one can, and especially we, as in we do. Smell the mint? Who does? Me and Lindsay Lohan? We think, if lintily, but I do know, we do know this, don't we, that I am writing a poem. Some of us like to be reminded of this at regular intervals. It makes us feel justified somehow, it seems. But more do not, and think conjunctions, adverbs, prepositions are such presumptuous, abstracted devils. They want to smell the mint. But even here, in poem, we are not saved from cogitating. And anyway, if you think on things, Lucretius said, it'll learn you to relax. And Virgil, he found verses appropriate to advise on sheep dip. Now, a lot of the poems in this book are cogitating, one way or another. And so what are they cogitating about? Well, one set of things is trying to understand how things work mechanically, the world, the universe, nature. And there are several poems that deal with various aspects of this. I'm obviously just going to choose one or two. This is a little sequence of poems that takes off from something I read by the physicist Richard Feynman, who thought he pretty much understand everything. He also thought that there was no reason at all why human beings couldn't have at least as good a sense of smell as dogs do. And his party trick was to try to demonstrate this. Not altogether successfully, I guess. Anyway, Feynman writes in a book encouragingly called Six Easy Pieces, except they're not. We try gradually, he says, to analyse all things, put together things which at first sight seem different, with the hope that we may be able to reduce the number of different things and thereby understand them better. So different things may have the same fundamental properties or behaviours, even though they seem very different. Wave motion might be an instance. similarity in the structure of how wind, air moves, wave, water moves, and or indeed geology, sand, different kinds of rock, gravel, the surface of the moon, the surface of the earth. So that's what these poems are about. They're called "We May Be Able to Reduce the Number of Different Things." But there are some particular visitors. The scene of several of the poems is something I don't do quite so much now, but used to do a good deal of, which was walking obstreperous Springer Spaniels along the riverbank of the Mersey, and where I'm not much of a nature watcher really, but where from time to time one might see a fox, one might see a heron, and a fox and a heron crop up in quite a few of these poems, and they do in the few that I'm going to read now, along with the dogs. Here, on my little river beach with Feynman, he who professes the nose of a spaniel, I practice the learned thought of how the local heron will feel the same current in air as in water, that this flow slips by the delta wing, rips the tide round Sark, braces the fox as he sets his mask for home, and that all these can be understood together, drawn in lines that themselves bear nothing, move nothing, yet, with just the faintest nudge for variables, display the laws that bring the log ashore like a heavy man. It's foreign ground, the sand beneath the fox's foot, river-borne to the beach by his sloping wood. And he shakes it from him as he climbs back into dry shadow and leaf ground. This outcrop under his paw could, in some grindings, also be sand. In a separate action, rising with the moon, the heron lifts and folds itself back. Moon, gritstone, sand. Third one. Rule. There is no cagoule, makes no noise. But before that, much before our yap and the dogs skidding in the leaves, with, at most, the push of a breath 100 yards before, we have the heron's attention. It is like a whisper into a dish, collected and conveyed, like the bang on a can, the scratch orchestra, 4 minutes and whatever of any sound, and resolves with them to a known line, which is in turn like the light wave, a pond stirring, a hot wire, the Barkans of Turkestan, the Medanos of Peru, and, we're bound to think this way, fibrillation, quivering in the heart. She used to say, I can sit here and hear it pounding. Another cogitation in this part of the book has to do with number. There is number and the flux, said Bertrand Russell. And here are a few poems about the mystery of number. There is a shoot of stones or swallows, the fringe drops of a storm. There is number, or there is not. Than that there is, nothing is more surprising in nature. Than that we find it anyway, nothing is more surprising in nature. This has been noticed more than once. But either way, are they the figures austere enough? take five. Drums, bass, rhythm, lead, and vocals. In a pub in Ashton-under-Lyne or Newcastle-under-Lyne. Hell's Kitchen, a garage in Texas, a dark park in Dortmund. Matthews, McElroy, Mortensen, Moody, Mitchell, though they've never played together, would that they had. Only for Stoke, though. Napoleon's victories. Austerlitz, Eylau, Jena, Wagram, Borodino. Borodino? Not so fast, says Tolstoy. Cloudlets of smoke. Historical science in its endeavour to draw nearer to the truth. The smell of saltpeter and blood. Gimme five. I'll give it five. Top five, first five, five star, five live, fish alive, more than, less than, trochaic five, best of five, starting five, Fraser, Bradley, Barnett, DeBuscher and Reed, iambic five, not quite. But did they play together? They did play together. And didn't they play, Terry? And I see you in a dream, on fifth above fifth, your jump shot fading to the basket. Five for the symbols at your door. Brag, stud, par, petals, loaves, parts of the body. Here, independent of all things, is the use, wonder, and beauty of what we cannot see. That poem's called The Abstraction of Number is Beautiful. And there are numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, but very, very interestingly, very, very importantly, there is zero, or the concept of zero. I don't know whether there's anyone else here old enough to remember the primitive early arithmetic classes, which featured tens and units, which existed physically in what would effect a kind of bundles of lollipop sticks, 10 of them that were bundled together and went into a pouch, and 10 of them go into another pouch, and so on and so on. So what is the for zero? The figure for zero came quite late into the Western world, I understand. It was very long known in India and in Arabia. I'm a part of a variety of Arab numerals. And it was known in those languages as shunya or zafira, a word very close to zephyr. It's the paradox of something that stands for nothing. It enables, of course, the transcription of high numbers and calculation, and is crucial in bookkeeping. Made bookkeeping altogether a lot easier. I mean, think about how to represent, well, let's pluck a figure from the air. $700 billion, for example. And start to imagine that in tally sticks or Roman numerals or even on an abacus. You see the usefulness of zero. But there was a lot of anxiety about what was called algorism when zero appeared, because what is zero? Zero is nothing. But it's representing something, maybe, and some people indeed. Something behind the noughts. And these three poems are about this. And with the Indian figures 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and Zafira, all calculations are democratically possible. 1. We could, by algorithm, tell the gravel of the sea. Though would such a use count among its treasures? Written in the sand, the tens and units would stretch along the shore, but its few strokes still economize on abysses. Without Zephyra, there was nothing, no way of writing nothing. With it, every distance, every credit, every debt, and how the universe bends round itself. The decrees of physics are the decrees of fate. 2. That so much and so many could be hidden in these ciphers. That is the mystery the Saracens have brought us in Sifra, Sapphira, a breath of the west wind. Yet less even than that, the bundled sticks of stars, the gravel sets, zero, shunya, empty hands, nothing. And the third is called a real sum is a sum of real people. But I can catch a chill, an algorie indeed, as I glimpse something fearful in ciphering. What those might have meant who called it easy Satanism, the million dead, so easily summed up. Neither one, nor two, nor three, but a poor cipher. We can be who we are, but other men stand for no more than ciphers in algorithm. They are the versatile sand wave and do not stand. Now, you may, in these poems that I've read so far, and in others in the book, you may detect a measure of uncertainty, even anxiety, in the treatment of these apparently implacable, concrete topics. There's a persistent sense that system, clarity, certainty, even knowledge is an illusion. The old unsettling conundrum as to what we find in nature is what we've hidden there, although we think we're looking on as impartial observers. This is obviously an endless scientific philosophical conundrum. And these three poems treat of that. The first one is called By Categories Do We Maester, helpful brackets, master the world. I'm not altogether sure why I insisted in the title of this, of having this kind of North Country version of maester, but it came to me and I just can't let it go. So there are some things that are very unaccountable and maybe even errors in a poem, I don't know. Anyway, this is called By Categories Do We Maester This World. We always think that we are looking on, looking in, that it is in us to see, that it is the long-nosed mouse underground gobbling the artichoke roots, that the diamond back is a heat seeker, that we can read the broken sand revealed by dawn, the scutter marks and fine drilling, all for food and danger. We always think we are looking on, looking in. Sand, scutter, snake, snout mouse. If we speak them, they will be, and made ours by arrangement. The bones rattle cunningly in a cup, scutter across the bays till time runs out, and warming will work for any creature of the genus ectotherm, though it must be tested, and skink shall beget skink unto the last generation. Yet we are made lonely by our categories, for nothing else owns them. We have a longing, I think, for what I'm calling here laws. We so love the laws. We so love the laws, we will rush into crazy houses, into the pill that makes us small, shriek at mirrors that draw us out like gum or smear us across the glass, knowing it's all four square really, your Harlech Castle, your Tower of London, load-bearing up to the attic, the skylight, the stars, some of which we know will be where we find them. Or they might, like this world does, say, you know I am here, but then shuffle, so three will not follow two. The lift might go in any direction. The turn right to the shops will not be the same turn up tomorrow. So I settle on tapping the same tooth for hours. Look at one horseman in the carpet forever. I hear this noise, oof, 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 oof. But there's nothing in it. What is this that my skin? Now why I might have some, a yen for, you can't really occur to be a nostalgia, can it? A yen for system and order. I don't altogether know. I'll hazard a suggestion in this little, or a hint perhaps in this little family poem about a very nearly disastrous holiday. Our word for today is system. Dad liked systems of his own devising, such as those for the filing of guarantees, the storage of plant pots and raffia, booking the South Coast allocation train, the allocation train. All this seeks and defends. Go on spec. You could be out on the street at 7 in the morning. And what we want is all the three of us together with a song in our heart along the prom, 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 tiddly om, pom, pom, and everything going according to plan. Now, if there's an even greater problem to cogitate upon beyond how do things work, it's why do they work? What is its purpose? Is there any purpose behind what works around us? And this is the main idea that concerns the Mere Bagatelle sequence, which has an epigraph from a philosopher, Jerry Fodor. I'll make use of the screen again. I found this in a review in one of the papers quite a long time ago. Sometimes, out of the corner of an eye, at the moment which is not action or inaction, one can glimpse the true scientific vision. Austere, tragic, alienated, and supremely beautiful. A world that isn't for anything. A world that is just there. Now, the sequence Mere Bagatelle is a series of variations, or maybe Bagatelle indeed, which treat this theme directly or obliquely, and it picks up recurrently on various words from the quotation. Corner of the eye, glimpse, which of course are very closely associated. Austere, beautiful. I'm fascinated as to why Fodor brings in this phrase, supremely beautiful. Exactly what he means by beauty here puzzles me. And this one, just there. Now I can't. You'd be glad to hear. Read the whole sequence. So I'll just pick out some parts of it or some strands. One recurrent strand. Has to do with art and with storytelling, and of all the different kinds of human efforts to glimpse significance, to make sense through stories and through representations. Stories of the gods, for example, and I refer to this as off and on as the saga. So I'll read a few of these. So what could be the paragons by which we see ourselves? the gods nagged and are gone. Discontinued the huffers, puffers, randy, watery, windy, owl-eyed, blood-drenched interferers, presidents of rocks, springs, boggart and quarry holes. See how easy this embellishing is. Though even with just the one who has no body, hearts or passions, a tossed date stone puts out an eye and starts some tale running. Meanwhile, on they go, the vast rondeurs. The vast rondeurs, incidentally, is a phrase Whitman uses for the enormity of the heavens. Meanwhile, on they go, the vast rondeurs, swimming past Neptune, and the base pairs and the conserved sequences, and our surprising cousin, yeast, copying itself, varying, selecting, and thus going on. And I will call him cousin, not just to humble us, but because he must be found a place in the saga. But again, what would the saga be in which we do meet ourselves? It should be a story of good heart, of cousinhood or uncleship. Let me listen. Let me, for a brief while, lay down this solitary bachelorship of mine. That should be the lyrics, book, and score. A few quotations in that one from Charles Lamb. If it is not, if that cannot be assured to us, who could bear a story where her imprisonment was never at an end, where both were eaten by every dragon, where we are the giant's footfall and feel nothing but his rage? Each of these would be a story that returns us nothing, as where the souls are harried and fly, but never move. Words, and other of our imaginings, lines, sounds, are the confounding of nature. Enough already, cries she, of Jairus' daughter, 12, and the combing out of hell, or even Homer Simpson squeezed through a wormhole and escaped to tell. These are uneven and unfinished doings, grass cuttings, mere bagatelle. So, if we see this true scientific vision, is all then calm? Can we chill, like Lucretius said? Well, death still devours and is called noisy, the rapid, savage chatter, and we, all of us, waiting and wailing. But to know that the moon is not, in fact, in travail, that the winter sun is not, day by day, the more distracted and incapable, but to see that, yes, it's short-winded, but not so far advanced, and remission is likely, does this lighten our step and refresh us? If we can see through, then blessed are we. And I mean lucky now. Now, the book closes, and I'll close this evening, with three poems called, the collective title, Call Death and Observation. In all this fishing for clarity among the rubble, observation, definition, and measurement recur, since they're all efforts of definition and certainty. These three poems have a core place in terms of their action and their impetus. their source. And that place was the intensive care unit where my mother spent her last weeks. And spending time there, I became fascinated with the system and systems of measurement and precision, particularly of what they called, which I thought was a strangely old, seemed to be a strangely old-fashioned word, but was always used, the bolus, meaning the precise dosage of drugs. And that's, this word occurs in the poems. So it's in the context of this precision that the poems ponder something like, I think, how clear is death? Called death an observation. One. Call death an observation, a supplied fact, ever more precisely noted, though mistakes have been made. Ask any Goth. And some vital sign may still be missed. A monitoring may be merely mechanical, conducted dozily after lunch, or not adhere to best practice. But from the many instances, the law, we die, has been induced. And if shaggy at first, improvised, and may still be so compared with what might be to come, is now deduced. The maths showing us how much we can infer of what we do not know. It seems irrefragable, and as long as the law coincides with observation, it holds. Two. If lines and circles are all our own work, have we invented death? Motionlessness seems to be what was decided upon, that she or he could no longer shift for herself and would just try there, or deliquesce, depending. Although many, most, have traditionally not gone on such appearances. But when forced to give up, say, but this is not the real line. What is real has no lines, because no space or time, because a line must be an act in time and mind, because it is not bearable to live with lines and circles. Three. Mathematics makes up the bolus. What could be truer than such proceedings? The equations of fluids in and fluids out, the charting and cross-checking towards a line to be pronounced upon, the baby-like milky regurge at the corner of the mouth sent out, uncalibrated, bubbling slightly. But somewhere there, the point. It happens always, and the line is true. And before the May dawn, the conventional dream ship, bulk cargo freighter, or sharp proud liner, the Black Normandy or another such, seemingly unworked, eyeless, unhurried, and knowing you cannot row aside. And I'll finish there, thank you.
Jeffrey Andrew has asked me to give you an elegant vote of thanks, and this is not something that is given unto me after the elegance of your reading. The photo quote, which you've taken away, and the photo quote, which was there a moment ago, surely you do understand that, don't you? You do realize that that is the same observation which Stevens pursues in The Snowman, that sense of observing a world which isn't distorted by...
Nothing that is.
Yes, it isn't distorted by a subject. So now you're... Good. I thought we'd have a little tutorial. What I loved about these poems is the continual presence in them of Whitman and a love of the world, but a puzzled love which is trying to sort things out. And I hadn't really realized until you were reading that last poem how much of a piece these are with the early poems. With the Munster poem, for example, into which you introduce autobiographical elements in a very subtle and a very undistorting way, in a way which bridges time and bridges your lives. And the lines that really struck me as being, as it were, from your recent experience and full of a really intense love are the lines about the baby-like milky regurge. And those are the lines that a grandfather might have written with great affection and with great precision, but without sentimentality. I have confirmed for myself, as your publisher, that this is a wonderful book, and I'm really very proud to have published it. And I think you will all be proud to have been here this evening, to have heard Geoffrey read it, and then, of course, to get him to sign your copy on the way out. But can I thank you again, Geoffrey, most emphatically.